Hello, folks, and welcome back to another edition of Blitz Scalable Venture Deals. I am Chris Yeh, and I'm joined, as always, by my partner at Blitz Scaling Ventures, Scott Johnson. How you doing, Scott?
Feeling good, Chris. Middle of February, a little cold here in the East Coast, but a nice day to be talking to you.
It's cold out here in Palo Alto, too. Really, really quite a distressing thing. I live here in California, so I don't have the cold. And it's a frigid, like, 55 degrees or something.
Oh, my goodness. Well, just don't go outside and you won't die from exposure.
Yeah. So as you heard, it's February, which means we are looking at the deals for January of 2023. What are the overall metrics for January?
Well, there were 55 total deals announced by the top VCs that we track. And that's down more than, it's like a third of what it was a year ago. So significantly down still. Remember, there was a big sort of step function in midsummer where we went down to about 80 and then even lower in Q4. And we're kind of staying around there. And it's important to remind people, however, that these are announced deals. And I bet you there are twice this many that are unannounced. And the unannounced deals are bridge rounds, inside rounds, all kinds of defensive, you know, because the existing investors sort of closing ranks around the companies that they like. And those deals don't get announced. That's not something where you wave the flag and say, look what we've done. So I think there's a lot more activity out there than these numbers are showing. But, you know, it is telling that it's 55 sort of new deals. That means it's a tough time to raise money.
Right. And that 55 is even higher than it actually was over the past couple of months. So technically, it's a bit of a comeback. It's just such a huge drop from where it was before.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think not a lot of stuff gets announced in December because no one's paying attention. So there might be some delay in announcing things. And that's why December can be depressed and January might get a pop. That I'm just theorizing. I don't know. U.S. deals were 40 out of the 55, so very U.S. centric. Now that makes sense because the firms we follow are mostly U.S. firms. And the seed and A rounds combined were 33 of the 55. So as usual, a high focus on the early stage. And Series B and C were only 16 total. So growth stage is struggling. I think a lot of those growth companies are doing inside rounds. And the numbers would be certainly a lot higher if all those inside rounds for growth stage companies were announced. So, you know, it's not the boom times that it was 18 months ago by any means.
Well, that's definitely a big shift. I think that the other thing to remember is that when this downturn started happening, Scott, you had actually done some research looking at prior downturns. And I think you said it was generally 4 to 5 quarters of lower activity. So I think we're a little over 2 quarters in.
Yeah. And that was, you know, we don't have a lot of downturns to look at. We don't have, you know, N equals 30 for statistical relevance here. We have a couple. So, it sort of makes sense that people sort of digest the new normal and start looking at, okay, what's exciting again? And it takes a little while to find something exciting again. Goodness knows that AI is the new thing that people are latching on to. And I heard that half of the Y Combinator companies that were presenting were AI, using ChatGPT in a unique way to, you know, do something in the medical field or do something in manufacturing. There's just so many new ideas springing from these large language models.
Well, I do think that, you know, it's worth commenting on that just for a second, because it is a great illustration of how you need genuine excitement on the part of the market to be able to have this kind of a boom. With the AI stuff, you know, people have been talking about AI for quite some time. Large language models, deep neural networks, all of these things had been around for a while. And the catalyst, of course, is the release of ChatGPT, which made it really accessible and suddenly got the general public excited. Everyone started talking about it. And this is not because some cabal of Silicon Valley type said, yes, we will now determine what the next big trend is. It's because it genuinely got people excited. And it's a great reminder that you know, even though we like to think of ourselves as having all this influence over what happens, it is the market and the individual consumers and buyers and people out there who collectively decide on things.
Well, and ChatGPT is a big step forward. Let's not forget that our experience with AI thus far is the little chatbots that you get on websites that don't answer any of your questions, or autocorrect, or the phone tree that you try to, you know, tell the automated attendant what you want to do and they misinterpret it and send you somewhere where you don't want to be. So it's been a horrible experience with AI thus far. Not to mention, you know, self-driving, everybody thought that was going to happen quickly. And boy, sensor fusion turns out to be a really tough problem. And so it hasn't really broken through in a way that ChatGPT did, which just blew everybody's socks off. They got just like, wow, this is amazing. And it hasn't been amazing so far. So that's the big difference.
Well, there you go. But it is something that we will keep a close eye on, obviously. We haven't seen it really start to pop through to our filters just yet, but we are seeing more AI, and we'll keep an eye out for that. I certainly remain very excited about the possibility of AI, but I'm also very realistic. As you know, I try not to get too excited about things like Web3 when people are talking about the promise, when I'm like, okay, well, how does it actually work? How is it going to be useful? I think there's easier ways to figure out how ChatGPT and other things like that will be useful, but we still have to do it.
Yeah, I would say it's night and day. I would say that everybody was scratching their head about Web3, and there are some people trying to explain it and they couldn't. And there's no way to do it, have a hands-on sort of Web3 experience that you liked. And with this, it's night and day. People can explain what you could do with it in ways that people get excited about and understand right away. And that's what creates excitement. And Web3 was eyes glazing over. So this is a huge, I don't see them as related at all. I think this is the real thing. And Web3 is, you know, it's going to be like virtual reality, just this amazing thing that may happen someday.
Well, I do think you've touched on something that's really critical, which is, my guess is at this point in time, the number of people who have interacted with ChatGPT exceeds the total number of people who have ever had any sort of cryptocurrency wallet in their lifetimes. And it's just so much more accessible. It's something that people actually can touch and feel and see, as opposed to just taking on faith and acting on blind speculation. And that's why I think it's so exciting.
Well, that said, you know, there's a virtual currency play that we're going to talk about this month that is really exciting and is growing really, really fast. And it's a wallet. And specific applications of these technologies is what gets me excited. And the technology itself is like, okay, that could be an interesting enabler. And that's what you just said, right? It's like, okay, what are we going to do with it? And Livin, which is what we're going to talk about, is doing something really interesting with wallet and rewards and food and all, you know, rewards and food are things that I really like.
Well, let's dive into that right away, because we could not ask for a better segue or better, if you will, trigger for talking about Livin. Now, Livin is a deal which I have a special fondness for because of the circumstances under which we first became aware of it. So what happened was, when I was at South by Southwest in 2022, so nearly a year ago, I was doing my thing. I had a panel to moderate, and then I was checking out some of the other stuff and hanging out with various friends. And one of my friends and I went to one of these houses where they were holding events. It was, I believe, sponsored by Solana. I can't remember. It was one of the big crypto players. And among other things, when I was in this house, my friend and I got kicked out in order for them to be able to give room to Daryl McDaniels of Run DMC to do an interview about cryptocurrency. That is a great reflection of the fact that this is early 2022.
I love it.
And so, but what happened was, after I got kicked out for Daryl McDaniels, went and sat by the bar, and my friend went to the restroom. And while she was in the restroom, one of the people who happened to be there popped by and said hello. And this was a woman, as it turns out, named Grace, who was one of the founders of Livin. And she and I chatted, and then my friend came back and we all chatted, and they were talking about their various companies and stuff like that. And then finally she said, well, what do you do? And I said, well, you know, I am primarily known as an author, and I write books with my friend Reid Hoffman. You may have heard of our most recent book, Blitzscaling. At which point she began to scream and said, oh my God, that book is the book that saved our company. I'm like, oh, I really want to hear this story now. And she then told the story, which I later recorded on my phone and posted to YouTube. You can actually find it on the Chris Yeh YouTube channel. But she said, you know, they had started this company and it was in the field of, as we put it, loyalty and rewards for dining and food. And she and her brother had been bumping around doing this for some time, and it really hadn't taken off. And they were wondering, is this ever going to work? And her brother William had read Blitzscaling and listened to Masters of Scale and told Grace, you've got to read this book, fix it into your head. This is what we need to do in order to break out. And she read the book and the strategic decision they made. Up to that point, they'd been struggling to get adoption. And the strategic decision they made was to go to the largest chains that they've been talking with, the largest restaurant chains, and the ones who are most well known, and say, listen, we're just going to give this to you for free. We're not going to charge you money anymore. We just want you to start adopting it. And that broke the logjam. Those restaurants adopted Liven's product, and we'll hear more about that product in a second. That caused usage to take off. Many other restaurants followed suit, seeing that these market leaders were using Liven. Those big companies eventually came back and said, hey, we'd like to pay for this. We want to make sure that this is going to be reliable, that there's somebody we can talk to for customer service and everything like that. And from there, the company took off. And we're going to hear more about it then. But this is a case where literally the book Blitzscaling is responsible for the breakthrough success of the company.
Yeah. So exciting and amazing story. Love the story. But what on earth do they do? We've hinted at it, but really what's going on?
So this is what's really interesting.
Because this is a tried and failed space. People have tried to do this kind of loyalty program stuff for restaurants for so long. And it's just never taken, you know, yeah, they do gift certificates and that's probably a decent business for them. For these restaurants, but it's not something that is core that really helps them grow, and it doesn't create community around the restaurant. It's just sort of a nice cash flow thing. So, and it's very, very sporadically adopted. It's not something that is something that, you know, regular customers use. It's mostly for gifts. So there just hasn't been a good product market fit solution until now.
Yeah, and that's what's amazing, because what Liven has done is to take two things that have never worked, the first being loyalty for restaurants and the second being the blockchain and cryptocurrencies. And by fusing these two together, they have something that's super compelling. So what Liven does is they are blockchain based, and they allow restaurants and their customers to interact through these Liven dollars. Now there's two flavors of these Liven dollars. They're called by the company food dollars and brand dollars. So instead of two D's, just one D. So foo dollars, as in food dollars, and brand dollars, but it's only one D. And the key is this, the two really interact to help each other. The primary one that you might expect are the brand dollars. And what the brand dollars are is they are a customizable currency for each restaurant to offer its best customers. And so those brand dollars can only be used at the restaurant that sponsors them. They can be completely white labeled and customized, and led to some confusion when we were doing some of our due diligence calls, because one of the restaurateurs was talking about food dollars because he called it food dollars for his restaurant. But of course, that's a different terminology for Liven. And these brand dollars, which are tied to the restaurant, describe to show many of the same characteristics of a gift certificate, but much better. And the key is a gift certificate, it's basically a financial instrument. It's a way to get people to commit to some spending up front, and maybe there's some breakage and stuff like that that helps the economics. But it's not something that really does much beyond that. right? People use gift cards. Does the gift card actually produce any information on who it is and how much they're spending and what they're spending it on? Not really. It's something where people just become even more anonymous, if anything, right? Because oftentimes, you said, they're given as gifts. And with the brand dollars, what's happening instead is it's based on a customer account. So there's a direct relationship between the restaurant and the customer for the first time. Like, this has never happened in the past. This is the big thing that restaurants fail to have. They have failed to have a one-to-one relationship with their customers. Here, they have a relationship with their customers. Their customer has a specific account that these brand dollars go into. They can spend those brand dollars. And what's really clever is Livin has done the hard work of being able to hook up to the point of sale terminal at the restaurants. So the Livin account doesn't just have information on the brand dollars being built up and what they're being, how they're being spent and when they're being spent, but what they're being spent on. Like, what are the checks? What are the dishes being ordered? And so you know now, instead of just like, well, wait, this, I've seen this guy a lot. He must be a regular customer. You know how often the guy has come in. You know what he's ordered. You know how much he's spent. And the brand dollars are so much more flexible than a gift certificate. A gift certificate is just, hey, here's a dollar amount. But with the brand dollars, you could do things like offer specific discounts. Maybe it's, hey, Chris, we'd love to see you back. It happens to be that we know we're going to have a lull at 3 p.m. Why don't you come in at 3 p.m. and you'll get a discount? Or maybe come in at 8 p.m. and you'll get a discount. Or maybe order this particular dish and we'll give you a discount. There's so many more granular ways to do it than you could ever do it with a gift certificate. So, of course, the restaurants are excited. And we've talked to a number of these restaurants who have implemented it. And they've talked about how much value it's provided in terms of that customer relationship. But it goes beyond that. As I mentioned, Livin has two different flavors of dollars, and the other are the food dollars. And the food dollars are Livin's own currency, the LVN. That's the abbreviation it goes by. And those food dollars can be used at any restaurant in the Livin network. Now, why is this important? It's important on several levels. First of all, it allows Livin to provide a backstop to the customers who are buying the brand dollars. So you might be afraid, if I buy a bunch of brand dollars in this restaurant and the restaurant goes under, I'm SOL. What do I do? And in the case of Livin, they can backstop it and say, we'll convert those brand dollars to food dollars, and then you can spend them within the Livin network. Now, this creates certainty around being willing to make investments into the brand dollars. And as we heard from the due diligence calls, people surprisingly put a huge amount of money into these brand dollars. There are customers who put $1,000 in at a time, because they know that that money is safe and protected. But the other thing is, there's a whole bunch of network effects that come into play now, because those food dollars become more valuable the more restaurants there are in the network, because there's more choices of where to go. But at the same time, for the restaurants, being in the Livin network becomes more attractive the more people who have these food dollars, because now there's a potential audience that you can advertise to that might be interested in spending at your restaurant. And finally, having their own currency gives Livin control over the economic system, like being a central bank. Now they can do things like give away food dollars for customer acquisition. They can do so many more things because they control their own currency, in addition to having the restaurants having their brand dollars. So this system has created greater granularity, greater ability to manipulate and incentivize the customer, and it's resulted in happier customers. It's resulted in significant financial impact for the restaurants. And Livin is now in over 5,000 restaurants.
Well, let's not forget, you know, we talk a lot about winner take most. And from the consumer's point of view, you do not want a separate app for every darn restaurant that you go to.
That's right.
Right. So that was tried. And oh, yeah, my little coffee shop on the corner, I don't want their app. Like, it's 6 billion apps on my phone. No, you want a single app that is going to be attached to all the restaurants that you like. So you want Livin to own all the restaurants as the customer. And as the restaurant, you want Livin to own all the other restaurants, because the network becomes more powerful and can get more customers. And so it's a true network effect on both sides. And as you spend a lot of time explaining why the restaurateur loves it, the consumers love it too, because you can buy $100 worth of food for $75 if the restaurant wants to make a promo. And so it's not just like a gift certificate where $100 buys $100. The restaurant can tune that. And if they want to get a whole lot of people to commit to their restaurant up front, then they can kind of amplify their currency. And It works. And the most important thing is that once the restaurant proves to Livent that when they sell these brand dollars, people are going to come and spend the money and buy the food, then Livent is willing to lend against that. So if you get $400,000 worth of brand dollars purchased, then Livent will loan you a couple hundred thousand dollars to open a new location. These poor restaurateurs, because restaurants fail at the rate of about 30% per year, they can't go to banks. Banks really, really don't like working with them unless they're very, very proven, and most restaurants aren't. So this is a way to actually grow with your customers' money. And that is incredibly unique. And you think about the product market fit there, that nobody is offering anything like that. So I'm really excited about this product. I think that the sell to the restaurant is A, you build a community around your brand. B, you can grow faster because once you're a proven brand dollars issuer, we can see that you are and can lend against that. And C, the customers will spend more. That's another thing we didn't mention, but customers spend more money when they've already sort of spent the money up front and they actually got a bonus amount. Then they're going to order the better thing. They're slightly, you know, maybe they'll get the truffles on top or the, you know, just to throw their shrimp into the salad because it feels like they got it for free and they're going to be happier. So it's all it's all goodness on all sides of this network that's being created.
Well, and again, while at the time of this recording, we haven't made an investment yet, I think we're definitely trending in that direction. It's just an amazing story. And of course, we're not going to invest just based on the story, but just think about how phenomenal it'll be if Livent becomes the default way this is done all around the world. It's a hugely successful company. And it all started because the book Blitz Scaling helped save the company. That would be amazing.
Yes. And so let's cross our fingers and hope that that all comes true. As far as the total scoring goes, we spent a lot of time on Livent, so we should move on. But, you know, we talked about winner take most, and we're giving it a 9 out of 10 there. And it might be a 10 out of 10. We just haven't really proven that to ourselves yet. We said 9 out of 10 for viral growth. And then very unusually,
by the way, one thing to mention about the viral growth, one of the things that they do that's clever is they work with the POS systems as well. So they have alliances with folks like Lightspeed, which is a giant point of sale terminal provider and whatnot. They've also done some clever engineering to allow them to work compatibly with them, even when the folks haven't necessarily done a deal. And so those can also act as a distribution channel, but it's not perfect because Livent also offers their own point of sale service just in order to make sure that the customers don't have to have another POS in order to do it. And so there's a little bit of channel conflict, but there are some good distribution strategies going on as well.
Yeah. I was about to say product market fits a 9, and usually we're around
5,000 restaurants. I mean, it's there, it's proven. And yeah, these restaurants, Livent is representing 10%, 15%, 20%, 25% of their transaction volume.
Yeah, you talk to a restaurateur and cash is everything. And these guys have a cash solution that they've never seen before. That's transformative for the business. It's not just good product market fit, it's great. Market size is huge worldwide. Of course, it's a 10. Gross margins are great. This is, you know,
you control your own currency. It's the best business in the world.
Absolutely right. And scalability, you know, there's some support here. And like on the ground support that if your point of sale terminal goes down, you need someone to respond right away. So we gave an 8 out of 10 there and an 8 out of 10 for this op scalability as well. But it adds up to an 83. As everyone knows, 80 is our threshold. 79, not good enough. 80, yes, it's a blitz scaler. We're up above 80 here with an 83. So very excited about Livent, and they're going to be out raising a Series B that I think they're going to have no trouble raising given the growth projections that we saw. Okay, moving on to Paradigm. And this one is fascinating. So $203 million raised, and it's a Series A, but it isn't really. It's kind of a seed round because they don't have a product yet. They have a team, and the team is outstanding. The CEO has had multi-billion dollar exits and knows the investors that are coming in and personally, and is one of the most backable people there is in the world. And this makes my point that I always hit hard, which is that if you want to raise money from top tier venture capital firms, then all you need to be is somebody who's had several multi-billion dollar exits, or you need to be running a company that's growing so fast that you have no idea what to do, but you just need some capital to feed the growth. So you either have amazing traction or an amazing team. Other than that, it's going to be tough, right? So you need to raise money from, you know, sort of lesser sources or smaller funds or angels or people that know you and trust you and believe in you. There's a whole lot of other sources of money. But when you as an entrepreneur get frustrated, you see some company that doesn't have any traction and they just raise money from Benchmark and that's not fair. I guarantee you that the team is really strong and they're well known to the firm, or their traction is just amazing. That's just how it works. So these guys have the team, and that team evidently is worth $203 million for a product that doesn't even exist yet. And it's Arch Venture Partners and General Catalyst. They're out of New York. And if you want to check them out, it's paradigm.inc. And by the way, Liven is liven.love, www.liven.love. We didn't mention that, and they're out of Melbourne. So, you know, what are they doing that justifies such a raise, Chris?
Well, this is fascinating because it touches on another company we've talked about in the past on the podcast, which is Trialjectory. So clinical trials are very critical. They're critical to the pharmaceutical industry because they're how you get FDA approval and ultimately out to the market. They're also critical to patients because, especially in certain fields like cancer, for example, when they run out of answers, you need to go to clinical trials, and they may not work, but at least it gives you a chance, right? It's the most important thing in the world. And Trialjectory we liked because what they did is they had done a good job of going out there and coming up with a database of all the clinical trials they're going on and facilitating the ability to communicate with the people running those trials. And this is something where doctors actually use it to recommend to their family members who are suffering from a particular disease, hey, go check this out. You might be able to get in a clinical trial here or there. And that's great. But Trialjectory is essentially a Band-Aid on an existing system. And that existing system is one where all these different investigators run these clinical trials, basically like the different hospitals and the like, and they have all these antiquated technologies, and Trialjectory just puts a meta layer on top to make it easier to find the trials. What Paradigm is doing is a giant swing, and it could either succeed amazingly or it could ultimately fail because it's really hard to get people to do something different. But they are trying to build the operating system for clinical trials. And so the idea would be, from now on, you're going to use Paradigm to run your clinical trial. And that includes enrolling people, that includes reporting results. That means that everyone has a compatible platform on which everyone is recording their data in the same way, et cetera, et cetera. This is a big behavior change. But the bet is that this team has the credibility to actually make that happen because of past relationships, because of past accomplishments. If they do that, something like Trialjectory, which is a Band-Aid, is essentially wiped out because Paradigm has access to everything within its own system in a completely systematic way. There's no need for Band-Aids. There's no need for screen scraping. There's no need for any manual work. It's all done in the platform itself. I really hope that Paradigm succeeds because the clinical trials market is so messed up right now, but it requires doctors all over the country to change the way they do things, which is a very hard thing to do.
You're understating, like, the doctor behavior change is that's a very tall order.
Oh, yes.
It's an ocean boiling sort of an idea. And you know, you think $200 million is a lot of money, but when you look at the task they're taking on, there's probably, you know, five huge pieces of software. They're going to take $20 million each to build. So there's $100 million out the door. And then, you know, you need the other $100 million to start marketing this thing and getting people to use it. And you better show some real gains on day one, because people aren't going to adopt something that might be useful someday once the network's built. You don't want to have a day zero problem here. And It's a lot of software to build all at once that's going to work together and interoperate with hospital systems and patient records. And oh my God. So, wow. It is an ambitious undertaking, but the pace of innovation in medical is so fast now that clinical trials are the real bottleneck. I mean, if you're going to get something to market, you got to go through this clinical trial process, and it inherently takes time. But if you can speed up patient recruitment and do better targeting for the right patients to be in the right trials, then there's a lot of opportunity for health benefits for all mankind. So I think it's an important mission that they're on, and I agree with you. I hope they succeed.
Need I remind everyone that in the case of COVID-19, Moderna had started synthesizing the actual vaccine that many people have received within 24 hours of when the gene sequencing was complete. And the reason it took so long is clinical trials and manufacturing, but primarily clinical trials. And being able to get those clinical trials running faster, more effectively, means medicines get to market quicker, which is better for the pharmaceutical companies, but of course it's better for the patients, which is why we want to see them succeed. In terms of their market, we gave them a 9 out of 9 on both winner take most and viral growth. On winner take most, it's because they're building out an operating system with really strong lock-in. In terms of viral growth and distribution, it's because everyone is trying to find these clinical trials. The instant you just make it available to know what the trials are, the patients will find you. And of course, within the industry itself, it is relatively easy with the big pharma companies to just go to them and say, hey, we have a better way of doing clinical trials. Would you like to get your patents to be protecting your profits for longer because you get the product to market faster? And the answer is yes, please. So those are both a 9 out of 9. They're not quite a 10 out of 10 because there's still work involved and because it's still the case that people can say, well, we're still going to do it on our own. And it takes a while for an operating system to take over. Product market fit, they haven't made anything yet. Who knows, right? We gave them a 7 because these guys obviously know what they're doing, but holy smokes, we don't know. Market size, gross margin, 10 out of 10. Oh my God, this is such an opportunity. Org scalability, op scalability. You know, we gave them relatively high scores, 9 and 10, because we're talking about a team that has done this before, understands how to do this. It's relatively straightforward.
It's software.
There may be things that come up along the way, though. Again, dealing with doctors is such a freaking pain in the ass.
Yeah. The MD stands for minor deity. So they get an 80, and it's going to be a long time before we see product out of this company. But boy, good luck to them.
Absolutely.
Now, down to MacroFab, which is a wait for people who want to make electronics in the United States to go to one. It's a one-stop shop. So you don't have to go to somebody to build your chip and somebody else to build your circuit board and somebody else to build the housing. You can just go to this one place, and they have a bunch of vendors already there and it's plugged into the system, and you can get quotes really quickly, and you can get your product built really quickly, and you can get it built for the, you know, a fair price because the pricing is all vetted by this company. So it's essentially the sort of a product manager with great connections that is what we call a managed network. And we looked at a company like this called Zetwork a long time ago, like two, three years ago. And Zetwork had a nice exit and they did the same thing, but for, you know, real stuff, not electronics, just, you know, mechanical stuff. So a ladder that has to fit on your ship or something like that. You need, you know, specialized manufacturing for a particular part. You go to Zetwork, and they had in India a whole lot of contract manufacturers that would build it. And they sort of oversaw the process in the middle. And it was a nice two-sided marketplace play. That's what this is. So we like it. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about doing more semiconductor manufacturing and electronics building nearshore and in the US. And this is a play on that as well. So overall, nice deal. Series C, they have a lot of customers already. They built 750,000 circuit boards last year in the United States. $42 million Series C, and the investors are Foundry Group, and they're in Houston, Texas. It's Foundry Group, BMW, Edison Ventures, ATX. So it's a nice syndicate. It's a good growth round. It's not the 200 million that is trying to take on the entire world of clinical trials. You know, this is a much more manageable problem. 42 million is a nice amount of money, and they score an 80. And how does that happen, Chris?
Well, you may recall that we've talked before about these two-sided marketplaces and the Richer-Reed-Hoffman principle of two-sided marketplace network effects is it's a question of the transaction size, the transaction consideration, and the transaction differentiation. And again, something like a scooter rental service, you have a very small transaction that nobody really thinks about where there's no differentiation, which means you have a commodity, which means that you don't get strong network effects. In contrast, we're talking about manufacturing printed circuit boards. Each printed circuit board is its own unique design. You're working with EDA and CAD/CAM and all this kind of stuff. So this is a high value, high consideration, high selection being important because this is core to your product, right? This is not like something that's peripheral to an electronics product, like the casing or something like that. This is the printed circuit board itself, the heart of the device. So all of these things mean that these are in a good position from a network effect standpoint. So we gave it a winner take most of 9 simply because the one thing we're not doing is we're not bringing new manufacturers online, right? That's why Airbnb gets a 10, because the suppliers never existed. It's not like if Airbnb were just aggregating Hilton and Marriott, they wouldn't get a 10 out of 10. It's because they're getting you and me on board as hosts that gets them the 10 out of 10 that creates the winner take most. Viral growth and distribution, we gave them a high score here. And that's because there are so many players that can act as distribution partners, whether it is people who provide the design tools, people who are existing as manufacturers, maybe saying, hey, you know, why don't you guys use MacroFab to send in your quotes and requests, because it's more effective, less time, less effort to actually work up the quotes. And of course, you know, there's a two-sided network effect on quotes as well. I'm going to go where there's the most people to quote. I want to go where there's the most business to quote on. So all that helps in terms of building out viral growth and distribution. So we got 9 and 9. Product market fit, Series C, and we gave them an 8. Seems like they've already got a lot of printed circuit boards. Maybe we could even give them a slightly higher value of 9 if we really wanted to. But, you know, we're conservative here. Market size, enormous, 10 out of 10. Gross margin, two-sided marketplace, 10 out of 10. Org scalability and op scalability, 8 and 8. And that is because this requires actual human expertise, right? This is complicated stuff. This is, you know, knowing, having people who understand design tools, being able to moderate and mediate communications that are really deeply technical. So we want to make sure that there are actually good people involved on the service side. But that still works out to be an 80, which is blitz scalable, which makes it interesting. And especially because we weren't able to get into Zetwork, it was just a little too far along, too many big players involved. This might be an interesting one, a second chance, if you will.
Yeah, and you know, I want to comment on product market fit because it is the one real X factor when we do this scoring. We haven't used these products. And so we sort of use metrics that could estimate how good the product is or are sort of related to how good the product is. Like, you know, how far along are they? How many customers do they have? That kind of thing. And, you know, it's true that a Series C product isn't just going to have better product market fit than most Series A products that are just trying to find it. By the time you get to Series C, you've usually found a good degree of product market fit and you're growing pretty fast. So, you know, I wouldn't give them a 9 until we actually talk to some customers. Now, with Livin, we've talked to some customers, so we can feel pretty confident to give them a 9. With MacroFab, we haven't. So, you know, it just goes to show you, this is a screening tool, this scoring. This is not definitive. And we could learn a lot more about the company and change a bunch of these scores, and it could get better or worse. So remember, this is just a first pass filter from publicly available information, unless we happen to have a little more, like the case of Livent. But that's our caveat and explanation, once again, for how we do this scoring. And on to the last deal we're going to talk about, which is a company out of Berlin that's a seed stage deal called Slay. And Slay is something that is certainly welcome in the world of bullying that happens in schools. It's a positive social network where you get nothing but accolades for, you know, from your peers. And it's not usually the case that peers compliment peers just sort of for no particular reason, but this app enables them to do so by creating a really interesting social dynamic. Chris, why don't you talk about it?
Yeah. So the thing about Slay, and again, we're going to talk about Slay in general, but I think we're also going to talk about the dynamic around social networks. The thing about Slay is it is compliments only. And in order to do this, it has to be structured. So the product is highly structured around, hey, who at your school deserves a statue? Who is the smartest in the class? And so on and so forth. You nominate people for these honors. Right. And there's no negative things allowed. So it's not like who's the ugliest person, who's the biggest bitch, et cetera, et cetera. That is not part of Slay, even though, you know, perhaps there's a market for an anti-Slay.
Might grow faster.
Tea or something like that. Oh, my God. But this is what's interesting, right? Because one of the things that is most toxic about social media is the fact that people feel judged and it's had a negative impact on psychology and mental health, especially for young women. And so the possibility of a social network that has the same awesome business characteristics of a social network, but which does not have this toxic element is what's got everyone excited. That plus the traction, the early traction. So let's talk about the scoring and then let's talk about the backing, because this is interesting. The scoring is winner take most, as always, social network. If you can have a new form of interaction, which is what this is, and be the dominant player, which is what they can do if they are dominant at all the various high schools and other places where this might take place, they can get a 10 out of 10. Viral growth of distribution, we gave them a 9 out of 10, simply because it's not like a Facebook where you're like bringing out all your friends, but it is something where you're going to say, oh, you know what, I want to vote for this person, I want to tell them, hey, they should join, or alternately, I want more people to vote for me, I'm going to tell my friends to join this thing and vote for me as the class clown or what have you. So there's some strong reasons why there would be decent viral growth, not quite as important as Facebook, but still up there. So that's a 9 out of 10. Product market fit, we have no idea. And we're too old to access it. So it's super early, very low amount of money. We gave it a 5. And I'll talk more about why that actually may end up being justified in the long run and why this might not be a good investment despite the score. But we'll do that at the end. Market size, 10 out of 10. Gross margin, 10 out of 10. Because it's a social network, super easy set of interactions, org scalability, ops scalability. The big problem typically with social networks, having a giant army of moderators to moderate all the hate speech and bullying. You can't do that in this. It's brilliant. So the net score out of all this is 83. It would be even higher if the product market fit was good. But the question is it? Now, let's also mention the backers. I think, did you mention that Accel is the lead investor?
I can't remember. I think I skipped it. So that's an important consideration.
So Accel is the lead investor. There's a company coming out of Berlin, but it is really fascinating to see the list of the additional people listed as investors. So I'll just read off their names and I'll explain who they are. Alex Paul, Harry Stebbings, Ilka Paanen, and Kevin Weil. Now, to a lot of people, these names might not actually ring a bell, but I think it's important to say who they are. Alex Paul is one of the Chainsmokers, the famed electronic music duo. They actually have a venture capital firm called Mantis VC. He's invested. Harry Stebbings is the guy who runs the 20-Minute VC podcast. He's very famous because he turned being a podcaster about VC into actually being a VC himself and is generally known as a guy whose ear is very low to the ground, hearing about new trends. Ilka Paanen. Well, he is the CEO of Supercell, the giant gaming studio, totally understands youth culture, obviously super successful, has been a luminary in the video gaming field for almost two decades now. And then Kevin Weil is a very famous tech executive. He was a VP of product at Twitter, VP of product at Facebook. He's currently the president of Planet, which is the geoimaging company that has a network of satellites above the Earth. These are all big time luminaries that have participated in a $2.7 million seed round, which I find fascinating. What are the dynamics of that, Scott?
Well, you know, they're reaching across the ocean to Berlin for this thing. So somebody found it. I'm guessing one of those names that you saw on that
probably
list.
Ilkka Panin. So Alex, yeah. Harry, and Kevin are all US-based, right? I mean, obviously, if you're the chain smokers, you travel around the world. But Ilkka Panin is the European member of the syndicate, if you will.
Yeah. And so they probably brought it to a friend at Excel and said, you know, this looks pretty exciting. Why don't you come in with us and we'll see if we can help them grow. They've got a lot of expertise around the table. And I bet you there's a lot of early traction there. Getting back to my original mm-hmm. speech about mm-hmm. team and traction, this isn't a team play and this isn't a big check. So it's not as though this is, you know, Excel saying, yeah, we're all in on this one. It's one of their seed deals. They're not taking a board seat. They're just going to sort of watch and hope, but they must have some really good early traction. And Excel's I don't think they do a formal scoring the way we do, but they can look at the dynamics of this business model and say, okay, if this actually works, then it could be pretty cool. And maybe they're thinking like, you know, you could bring this to the enterprise. There's, you know, large companies, people get demoralized. It'd be really nice if there was a way to make people feel good without paying them more. And so they may have their eye towards that, who knows, but it's a good group of investors, and early on they've, you know, probably got some good traction.
Now let me share my skepticism, and my concern is that it could be a fad. And part of it is that there's a lot of things that just end up being fads when you're talking about teams. These things seem to rise and fall seemingly overnight. And there have been so many in the past, whether it be a Kick, for example, or a Whisper or a Secret or all of these things that get really a lot of attention very quickly and never go anywhere because, you know, the mob moves on to something else. The other concern I have is the very clever nature of the interactions around these short sort of like, hey, who deserves a statue? Who deserves props or credit or what have you? It's interesting, but will it get boring because it's so restricted? Will people feel like it actually is a matter of self-expression? Will they actually like it, or is it like end up just being something that's a small part of your day, like, oh, every year we vote on a homecoming queen and homecoming king?
Yeah.
So that's my concern about where this is going. Like,
well,
is
and that echoes compelling? You know, it echoes your concern about games, right? So games can suddenly be the most amazing thing that everybody focuses on, and there's a huge influx, and then you play the game and you kind of get it, and then it's not the big thing anymore, but this other one over here is, and everybody does that. So that social networks can be kind of gamey, if you let me use that word, and I think this one stands that risk more than many.
Yeah. So it's interesting, but it is intriguing enough. I mean, again, with Clubhouse, when we looked at Clubhouse, ultimately we passed. As I described, I didn't believe that the product market fit was going to be there. I didn't believe that they were actually serving a need. And it seems I was right, unfortunately, because of course we always root for entrepreneurs. But this is another one where I'm like, if something truly represents a different form of interactivity and is a new social network, the potential upside is so huge. I mean, as I always like to remind people, Peter Thiel and Reid Hoffman and Mark Pincus bought 10% of Facebook for $500,000. You can make a lot of failed investments if you have one Facebook to make up for it. And if Excel is like, yeah, we just bought 10% of Slave for $2 million. And, you know, there's a decent chance it fails, but if it succeeds, this could be a, you know, $100 billion company. Well, shoot, that's probably why you make this kind of investment, because the potential upside is so huge.
Yep. Okay. Well, that's the deals we're going to talk about today. There are four of them, and four high quality companies.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Even though, as you heard at the very beginning, folks, the volume is down, there continue to be great companies being funded, companies that we think have a chance to potentially be blitzscalers. We continue to be very excited about being investors. You can tell just from the excitement as we talk about companies like Livent, we're actively looking at investing. And I hope you can sense that, you know, even though we are in a market downturn right now, we continue to see promise out there. And I think it's only going to be a couple more quarters before we see a significant resurgence. And some people are talking about it happening already. So watch this space closely. We'll be continuing to monitor every month, and you'll be able to join us ringside and see what we see as we go through these deals.